wasn't any men around, I'd ask her to be my sponsor, but thank God there's men around. But that's not a dig. Anyway, I'd like to thank and welcome our speaker tonight, Beverly D.
Hi, everyone. My name is Beverly Douglas, and I am an alcoholic. I'm very proud to stand here tonight and tell you that I'm a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I've been asked to do this workshop on what I have found in the Big Book. I'm not here to tell you what you're going to find or how you're going to use it or even if you're going to use it. I'm only here to share my experience, strength, and hope with you and the ways that I have found in order for me to stay sober. And not feeling too swift tonight, and I told Jim I wished I could have brought a picture and played an old tape or something and set it up here. But I've kind of asked God to help put the words in my mouth and help me remember and get it together right for you. So maybe you can make some sense out of it. I found for myself that when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous that I was told that I had to change. If I wanted to stay sober, I was going to have to make some definite changes in my life. And I was told that one of the most important things that I was going to have to do was to find a new way to live. And I didn't quite understand when I first got here, you know, what you were talking about when you said a new way to live. And I got to thinking about it. And I began to find out as I stayed sober that in the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, as I began to apply them to my life, that there I was living a new way of life, that the actions that I was taking on a daily basis had changed. And it was then I began to find out that it was the principles that I had been living by that had created a lot of problems for me. And by principles, I have brought along some dictionary definitions. I'm very grateful that I have a sponsor who told me, Beverly, don't assume the meanings of words. Get into a dictionary and look them up. And I'm glad she did, although at the time she told me that, I was very angry about it because I'm very mentally lazy. And I've been accused of not speaking English, and I can understand I've gotten better at it, but I speak Southern. And when you speak the way I do, then when you go to pronounce your words, they're not spelt right. And then when you go to look them up in the dictionary, you can't find them because you don't know how to spell them. And so I had a lot of difficulty, so I would just assume the meanings of words instead of looking them up. And she said, no, you don't do that. You look them up, honey. So anyway, I began to. So in before starting here, I want you to understand when I'm talking about morals, principles, and values, what my definitions are with the dictionary. And it says that a principle is a standard or a rule of behavior, good behavior, hopefully. It's moral or ethical standards of judgment, okay? And I'm going to say that a principle, then, is an action that I take on a daily basis. It's the way that I live and behave. The actions that I take on a daily basis are the principles that we all live by. Okay? And I believe that for me, my principles are learned. I just sort of picked them up as I went along. I learned them from friends that I was with and from my home, my mom and my daddy, and from my teachers and out of books that I read and so on. And the people that I was around. Because I was a great chameleon, as many alcoholics are. You know, you put me on red, and I turn red, and you put me on blue, and I'll turn blue, and you put me on plaid, and I go crazy, you know, trying to be, you know, whatever all of that is. So what I found out by that was when I came into AA and I began to think back of how I had been living and the things that I had been doing while drinking. And I began to understand why principles were so important. And the dictionary definition I have of morals is relating to, or dealing with, or capable of making the distinction between right and wrong in conduct of character. Okay. In other words, and I believe that that's something that is an innate sense when we're born of right and wrong. I believe that most of us have that. And as we grow older, then it develops. Okay. And for values, I found out that the values are also a principle. That's the reason I connect them all together. Values are a principle or a standard or quality considered worthwhile or desirable. So the actions I take, I must consider them worthwhile or desirable, or else they're not right actions, are they? And I don't know about you, but a lot of actions I took while drinking were certainly not, even to me at the time, you know, worthy or worthwhile or desirable. And I didn't like myself for them. So when I got here, I really didn't like myself very much. And I didn't like myself because of the actions that I had been taking and the way I had been leading my life. And so as I began to stay sober, the actions that I began to take, and remember, action is the magic word here in Alcoholics Anonymous. You've heard that over and over and over again. And as I began to understand these things, I began to understand why they kept telling me that action was the magic word. It's the way I live my life that is going to determine whether I stay sober, whether I have any kind of peace of mind or contentment in my life. And I found that until I changed, nothing around me did change. But the minute I began to change, it was like everything began to change, and it was like a whole new world began to open up for me. And I'm standing there saying, wow, boy, you know, for a gal who thought she knew so damn much, you know, where have I been all my life? You know, it was just a wonderful feeling. So what I'm trying to say then is that's how I connect principles, morals, and values. So you know where I'm coming from as I go along and I'm talking. Now, it was the principles that I had been living by which went against my own set of morals or values that was creating so much of the problem in my life. So if you're living by principles that are going against your own set of values, I got where I didn't like myself. And if I didn't like myself, I didn't like you. And if I didn't like you, then I found ways of putting you down, whoever you were that was anywhere around me in my life. And as I began to change, I began to get some self-worth and some self-esteem. In other words, I began to get pride in myself, and I began to like myself. And as I began to like myself, then I learned how to love myself. And in loving me and liking me, I began to love and like you. And that was what made everything change so much. Now, in NAA, one of the first things I used to hear was the how of it. And to me, I found out that that was the first three steps. In the first step, where it says we admitted we were powerless over alcohol and that our lives had become unmanageable, I had a heck of a time with that. First off, I wasn't sure I was an alcoholic when I got here. I knew I was crazy. I'd been in the nut house. But I didn't know what alcoholism was at that time. So when I came in here and I found out that I was an alcoholic, you people told me that if I was alcoholic, that you were also, and that you would show me a way up and out of the living hell that I was in. And I didn't know it, but alcohol had taken me into that living hell. Didn't know it was alcohol, just thought it was because I was crazy, and I thought it was that son of a gun I was married to. And that's the reason I kept changing them. Okay. Anyway, as I began to understand this, what I began to find in the first step was the how. First one was honesty. When I could honestly admit that I was powerless over alcohol and that my life was unmanageable, when I could really admit that and accept that as a fact, I began to understand then. And there was an inner strength that come within me as far as alcohol was concerned that I had never, ever had before. I had been drinking since I was 13 years old. And when I finally got here to you people, I had gone through three husbands. I had been in the nut house. And I had killed myself because I could not stop drinking. I had gotten where I was going on binges, and I couldn't get off of them. And it used to be I was just a weekend drinker. I was a daily drinker. I was a weekend drunk, really. And right at the end, I'd start drinking, and I couldn't get off of it. I couldn't stop. And I was terrified. And that was when I decided to kill myself, because I had tried all of the things that so many of us have tried. I had tried psychiatry. I had tried medical doctors. I had tried churches, all different kinds of churches. And nothing worked for me when it came to getting me off of alcohol. And yet, just by that one simple step of really getting honest with myself, of learning what alcoholism was and honestly admitting that I was an alcoholic and it wasn't all those other things or him that was my problem, that inner strength came and I was able then to quit drinking. Now, on the second step, I learned in there the principle of open-mindedness. And when I talk about open-mindedness, you people kept saying, I kept hearing the words, you know, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Well, as I said, I had no problem with that one. I had a certificate from UCLA, you know, stating that I was manic depressive. I was nuts. And which our book says it can write chapters about, you know, just chapters. So no problem there. However, when you were talking about that and you said that a power greater than myself, immediately, you know, I picked up the word God and I couldn't buy it. I simply could not buy God because I knew that religion did not work. And also, not only from my own experiences, I had been here long enough by that time to meet priests, ministers from different denominations, nuns, you know, people of the cloth. So if God worked, why were they here? And so I just had a terrible time with it. Now, my sponsor had told me, Beverly, you were a phony when you were out there drinking. You always had that facade up. And now that you're in here, you're going to practice honesty. Remember, I promised that in the first step. And now you're going to take, you know, and admit who you are and what you are. Well, I'm a son of a gun. In the second step, you people came along and said, well, if you don't believe in God, just act as if. I said, now, hey, wait a minute. You know, I was getting real confused. And I said, my sponsor just told me to be honest, and I'm turning around now, and you are telling me to be dishonest by acting as if. And you said, well, use us as a higher power. If you don't like the word God, use us as a higher power. But then, you know, while I'm thinking this thing over and trying to make a decision as to what I want to do, I remembered a little phrase that I had read somewhere as a child. And it went something like this. I would rather live my life as though there was a God and die and find out that there wasn't, then to live my life as though there was no God and then die and find out that there was. Now, I don't know about you, but that put the fear of God in me. And drunk or sober, there has always been two things that will motivate me into taking action. Remember I said action was the magic word? Drunk or sober, fear and pain will cause me to take an action. And when I remembered that, I thought, oh, God, you know, I think I'll act as if. So that was the premise I started off on. Now, you people also told me that I didn't have to buy it all right now. That if I didn't want to believe in God right now, that that was okay. As I said, just, you know, use you as my higher power. And I thought, well, okay, I'll do that. Now, you see, I've come to believe that God also works through people. And I know He was working through you people at this time in my life. And then the other thing was, is that I kept hearing this word, spiritual. And I thought, oh God, here we go again. We're back to religion. And I thought, I simply can't do this. Well, my sponsor says, well, Beverly, what do you think spiritual means? Well, it's religious doctrine. Got something to do with religion. She said, not necessarily. She said, have you looked it up in the dictionary? And I said, well, no. Well, then get your dictionary out and let's take a look at it. So I did. And the connotation that I got from the dictionary was very, very simple. There's a lot of different meanings for it, but the one that helped me so much that I was able to accept in the beginning was spiritual is very simple. It's an elevation of thought and feeling. And I could buy that. Simply an elevation of thought and feeling. Now, from the kind of a drunken woman I was to the kind of a person I was when I quit drinking, there was just automatically some changes that came about that I didn't even have to do anything except quit drinking. So I automatically had an elevation thought and feeling. So without even recognizing it, I had become spiritual. All right. Now, in that second step, as I said, what I found there for me was the principle of open-mindedness. The principle of open-mindedness. Now, I know that a lot of you have heard my husband talk, and those of you who have know that before he even begins and identifies himself as an alcoholic, this is what he always says. There is a principle which is a bar against all information, which is proof against all argument, and which cannot fail to keep a man in everlasting ignorance. That principle is contempt prior to investigation. And that comes out of a spiritual experience in the back of our big book in the appendix, if you're interested in knowing where it is in our big book. Because what I'm doing tonight is everything that I am talking on, I am not giving you an opinion. I am telling you what's in here written in black and white and the experiences I've had and what I've learned from this. Now, I had the kind of a sponsor who said, honey, thou shalt have no other gods before me. I mean, she was a real whip. I kid you not. And I'm very grateful that I had her in the beginning because for me that was what I needed. And I remember one day threatening her with getting drunk. I see you've never done that, huh? Okay. And she looked over at me. And she said, let me tell you something, Beverly. If you decide to get drunk, she said, I want you to know I'm not responsible for that. And I remember looking over at her and I said, well, okay, you know. I could see she was a little upset with me. And then I must have said something else to her and she got up and then went to walk away from the table. And she stopped and she turned around and she came back. And she looked down at me and she said, and by the way, I remember that you're suicidal too. And she said, I want you to know that if you decide to commit suicide, I'm not responsible for that either. Well, I thought about that one for a minute, and I looked up at her, and I said, well, damn it, you're my sponsor. What the heck are you responsible for then? And she reached over, and she grabbed my big book, and she shook it down and hit me right across the bridge of my nose. And she said, I'm responsible for helping you to learn what's in this book and how to apply it to your life. And I wasn't too happy with that because, you see, all my life I'd had a boss. And I never realized that. And I never realized why I had a boss. So I got to thinking about that because I got her because I wanted somebody to be responsible, right? After all, I was just a poor, sick, suffering alcoholic, and somebody had to be responsible for me. She had told me many times I hadn't done too good of a job with my life, and I'd better learn to follow directions. Now she's turned around and telling me she's not going to be responsible. It's no wonder we're confused all the time. You know. So anyway, you know, that's what I'm telling you is I'm not responsible. We have to learn how to think sober. And that's what the program and sponsors help us to do. How to learn how to think sober. Now, in this book, you're going to find words like precisely, absolutely, specifically. And it even goes on and says it gives us clear-cut direction. Now, that really doesn't leave any room for the fertile imagination to run around in. And I was real disappointed at that. But anyway, I told her, okay. And what I'm saying to you is this. I don't care how much you read this book, how much you memorize it, how much you spout it out in meetings or from podiums like this. Until you take these principles or these steps and use them in your life, they have no value. Absolutely none. But the most beautiful thing about it is that once you begin to find your own principles, your own values out of these steps that fit your pattern of life or your lifestyle that you want to lead, it then becomes yours. It is now yours, and there is a knowing inside of you that you've never, ever had before. And if you have done this, if you have taken some of these steps and used them and found that they work, you know what I'm talking about. So, as I kept on, what I'm saying is that in the second step, when I came to believe that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity, and they said, you don't have to buy it all right now, just keep an open mind. I came to believe. Eventually that happened. I know that when I went, you know, I went on a search. I didn't just go on a search for spirituality. Anybody could do that. I went on the search for God. You know, I want firsthand information. I want to meet the top man. I want it all, and I want it right now. So I did what any good woman alcoholic does. My sponsor had told me to stay away from a place called the Allen Nest over in the valley. And the reason she told me to stay away from there is because she said there was a bunch of dirty old men helping women with their spiritual program. So I did. I stayed away from the Allen Nest. I went to the Valley Club. I'm not dumb. And there was a man there, and I went to him to ask me for help with his spiritual program. And I told him I was in my search for God. And he said, well, he said, Beverly, I don't know whether you're ever going to find God or not. But he said, let me tell you what I found for me. He said, I hope you know the valley so that you'll know what I'm talking about, because I don't know Simi well enough to tell you how to do it this way. But if you will get on Sherman Way and you will head east on Sherman Way, you have got to cross Sepulveda. Okay? If you just stay on the path, stay on Sherman Way, and keep heading east, invariably you have got to cross Sepulveda. And that's what he was telling me, that if I would get into this book and I would get on this path, you see, it says, rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. That tells me a couple of things. One of the things it tells me is that there's only one path. There is no S on path. And yet I hear people saying, oh, you can just work this program any way you want to. If you hear somebody say that, you know, go up and ask them, you know, what does the book say? Because that's not what the book says. The book says there's only one path. And what is that path? Well, I found in the book that it said to me when I went back and started reading it again, looking for the answers. You see, when I got here, I knew all the answers. It was the questions I didn't know. So I asked myself, Beverly, what are they talking about? You see, and I couldn't do this before because I didn't have any validation. I had to come to you or him or them, you know, to validate. My thinking had no validation at all. And it had simply never occurred to me. It was one of those things that had never occurred to me, is to ask myself, Beverly, what do you think about that? Because if you don't like yourself and you don't have any self-worth or self-esteem, then your answers ain't going to mean anything, or your questions either, are they? And so I was kind of stuck with that one. But by now, I'm beginning to get some self-worth. So I asked myself, well, what are they talking about? I got back in the book, and this is what I found. It says that a lack of power is our dilemma. And to find this power greater than ourselves that will solve our problem is exactly, there's one of those words, exactly what this book is all about. Pray then, will you tell me why so many of us come in here think we're going to get emotionally well and we're going to be okay? I did. I kept thinking, if I can just get my life straightened out, man, if I can just get rid of these emotions, I'm going to be okay. And that, again, is not what the book says. It says when the spiritual malady is overcome, then we straighten out physically and mentally. So I was doing it backwards, and you'll find that alcoholics do that. They do everything backwards, totally backwards, not right or wrong, just backwards. The normal person will think, and from his thoughts, after thinking it over, he will take an action. And from that action that he takes, usually, he will have a good feeling. Not the alcoholic. He will feel first, and usually it's a bad feeling, and then he will react right away. And of course, when you got a bad feeling and you have a reaction, it's usually a bad reaction. And then maybe, you know, if he's a quick thinker, he'll think about it next week. Or what he'll do is, when he takes a bad action, then the person that he's taking that action toward will retaliate. And he'll feel bad again, and he'll take another bad action, and you get caught in that squirrel cage, and you're going around and around again. And we did that with booze, so we know what that's like. So there I was. A lack of power is our dilemma, and to find this power greater than ourself that will solve our problem. And you will hear me say that over and over and over again. We have begun to find a source now, a source of power that we've not had before. And even those of us who have had a religious background and religious training have never really achieved how to use this power, how to use it. If they had it, they wouldn't have had been here. So something was missing. And I remember that when I sobered up in September, And at Christmas time that year, I'd been in AA a few months by then, and my psychiatrist had told me that I didn't need him any longer. And he said to me, he said, "Beverly, what did you find in Alcoholics Anonymous that you didn't get here?" And immediately I knew the answer without even thinking about it. I said, "I found God." It was that simple. I had walked around most of my life searching for something. There was an emptiness or a hole in my gut, whatever you want to call it. I remember when I was in the nut house, and I remember walking down the hall with my psychiatrist. And I remember taking my hand, literally, and going, making a fist, and showing him, turning around and saying, "Look at me, look at me, can't you see this hole? I can put my hand right through myself." I mean, not that I was, you've got to remember, I was a little nuts at the time. And I really believed that I could put my fist, my hand, in this hole. And I couldn't understand why he couldn't see it, because I could see it and I could feel it. And somehow when I came here into Alcoholics Anonymous, that hole in my gut began to fill up. And this thing that I had been searching for began to take place. And I began to have a feeling of fulfillment within my life. And so without even needing to think, I told him, you know, "I found God." Now, it goes on to say in that same spot that we have written a book which we believe to be moral as well as spiritual. Now, I don't know what that's going to come to mean to you, but I can tell you what it came to mean to me. You see, I don't believe that my drunkenness was a moral issue. In fact, the book tells us that we were very ill people. But I have come to believe that my sobriety is. So it behooved me to begin to find out what my morals were. But in the meantime, I've still got another step to work. Now, there's a lot of argument that goes on when you're new. There's a lot of hair splitting, and I'm assuming it's still going on about what does this mean and what does that mean, and we take words and we bounce them around and get into dictionaries, and it's exciting, or it was to me. It was terribly exciting because I was beginning to learn and my mind was beginning to open up. I was doing what the principle of the second step said. I was beginning to have an open mind now. And I became willing, to listen. Not only to learn, but to listen. And what better way to learn than to listen? And so what I found out also, when it talked about there being, you know, rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path, it goes on to say, when I found out that there was only one path and what that path was, it says that there are three conditions that must be fulfilled before we can even get on that path. And that path is the 12 steps. That's how we grow spiritually, is through the 12 steps, through the principles that we learn in applying these steps to our lives. Now, the three conditions before we could even begin to steps are right there, and it says that if you have decided you want what we have and are willing to go to any length to get it, then you are ready to take certain steps. It took me a couple of years to even see that. I didn't even know it was there. We read it in every meeting out here. I didn't hear it. I didn't see it as many times as I've read it. So the conditions were I had to make a decision that I wanted what you had. Well, what did you have? See, I'm back to questions again. Because my comprehension is below average. Now, I don't know about you, but when I got here, I kept reading the book, and I'd shake my head yes, and by the time I'd gotten to the end of the paragraph, I had forgotten what it said. But I knew it was right, and I identified with it, but I just couldn't remember it. And that's the reason they keep telling us to keep coming back, you know, because we need to hear it over and over and over again. And certainly I did. So, okay, made a decision that I wanted, you know, what you had. That was condition number one. Have you decided you want what we have? And are willing to go to any length to get it. What we had was sobriety. We've got a lot more here than just sobriety. But what we had was sobriety. And willing to go to any length to get it. Well, sure, I've always been willing to go to any length to get what I wanted. Weren't you? Sure. And I was willing to pay the price until the time came to pay the price. And then sometimes the price was just too steep. And many of us at that point get drunk again. Because when we hit that price, you see, because I've heard people say and stand at the podiums and in meetings, oh, you can just do anything you want to do now that you're sober. Well, maybe they can, but I found I couldn't. Because you see, when I did anything I wanted to do, I found out I was going against my own set of morals and my own set of principles. And I got where I wasn't liking myself again. And when I got to that point where I wasn't liking me, then I wasn't liking you again. And when I don't like me and I don't like you, everything just goes to hell. And my mind starts saying, oh, this is the way it's always been. This is the way it's always going to be. And I just might as well be drunk. And we get right back into that self-pity. And if we stay with that long enough, we're in deep trouble. In deep trouble. So I had to find something. So I made the decision again, I would kill myself again. And as I had told you, I had committed suicide prior to getting here. In fact, that's how I finally made it, was killing myself. Now, I say that facetiously, and yet I believe for me that at that time I was reborn, and the book talks about a rebirth. I believe that as sick people, it's almost like I died, and when I got here to you people, I was reborn. I picked up my bed and I walked again. I literally picked up my bed and I walked again, and I came back to life. Thank you, sweetheart. After killing myself, I woke up 3.5 days later down at County General Hospital. I had tubes down my nose, my throat, both arms, and both ankles. It took them 3.5 days to bring me back to life. And it wasn't a play for sympathy. I really wanted to die. So I knew if I went back to drinking, I knew what I was going to become. I knew what I was becoming. And I knew I wouldn't want to live. And if alcohol itself didn't kill me, I knew I would. So I had to be willing to go to any length to victory over alcohol. Because you see, when I got here, I found out, I didn't know it at the time, but what I had done without realizing it is that I had made a choice. I had made a commitment to live other than die. It's not just a matter of not drinking. We don't just have a bad habit. We've got something. If you have alcoholism, I don't care what stages you're in, it's going to get worse. It will never get better. And the time will come when either alcohol itself will kill you in most cases, or you will end up killing yourself. We lose so many people to death through alcohol. I don't care how much drugs there is out there on the streets today, alcohol is still the number one killer, according to statistics. Again, it's not a bad habit. We've got a killer illness. And I was willing, I made that commitment to live other than to die. And I made the commitment that no matter what came or went in my life, no matter how bad or how good it got, that I would do everything that was necessary for me to do in order to stay sober. Now, so I've got honesty and open-mindedness out of the first two steps. And the book says that the first two steps, it used the word cornerstone. And again, I didn't know what that word meant. And so I looked it up in the dictionary. And a cornerstone is the very foundation of our program. My husband says that that I'm talking down to people when I explain these words, but I, you know, I don't believe I'm the only dumb one here, if y'all will pardon my expression, because I didn't know what a cornerstone was until I looked it up in the dictionary. I'd never even heard the word to my own knowledge. But it simply meant that the first two steps in our program, the honesty and the open-mindedness, is the very foundation of our program. So then I went into the third step. And in the third step, it called the third step the keystone. And again, I didn't know what a keystone was. And in that third step, where it says we made a decision to turn our life and our will over to the care of God as we understood Him. And I thought, you know, God, that's really going to be difficult. And I was having a lot of trouble, but I was acting as if. And in the meantime, I was using all of you as my higher power. But in there, it said that the first requirement being that we recognize the fact that any life led on self-will can hardly be a success. Well, I thought about that for a little while, and I thought, well, darn, you know, I wasn't self-willed, so that couldn't have been talking about me. You're grinning, Mary. And in fact, I was sitting up at the nest. I finally got over to the nest, and I'll talk about that a little later on. And I was sitting up there, and I was talking about, you know, how submissive and subservient I was, because my mom and my daughter and some friends were sitting around the table, and we were trying to find out what kind of a person that I really was. And they came up with the dictionary definitions of submissive and subservient. And that's the way I was with the man I was married to, or with most people, and I was that way for a reason. Is because in being submissive and subservient, it's a good way to manipulate to get what you want. Now, I never recognized that. And another reason that I was that way is because I needed your approval so badly that I would do anything that you wanted me to do in order to get it. And especially with a husband. I always felt, and in fact, the last ex one, was always telling me that if I didn't shape up, give him his goddamn key back and get the hell out of his house. And so I kept trying to shape up, you know, so that he wouldn't leave me. And I was sitting there expounding on this at a meeting one day up at the nest. And there was this man sitting up there, and he was drumming on the table. And finally, when I finished saying what I had to say, he jumped up and he looked over at me and he said, "Lady," he said, "did you ever stop to think that you really weren't submissive and subservient, that all you really was just a kiss ass?" Well, now, I'm telling you, when he said that to me, that just took the glamour right out of it, took the wind right out of my sails. And I didn't like that. Hurt my feelings. But when I got to thinking about it, he was right. And I want you to know that from that moment on, I have never been submissive or subservient. And I got even with him. I married him about 17 years ago. I bet he's sorry he ever said that to me. In fact, to hear him tell it, he'll tell you that he doesn't see any residuals of that at all. Doubts if I ever was. But anyway, here I am in this third step, and they're asking me now to turn my life and my will, to make this decision, turn my life and my will over to something or someone that I can't see, touch, feel, hear, you know. I'm not even sure it's there. But just turn my life and my will over to it. Well, I'm used to turning my life and my will over to my husband's, whoever he was at the time. But I just, you know, I just couldn't quite do that. And yet it said that how well I worked this step is going to depend upon the rest of my life. It's going to depend upon this. In fact, it says that my program and my very life depends upon how well I apply this step in my life. Now, my very program and my life depend upon how well I work that third step and bring it, and when I say work it, I'm talking about bringing it into my life and using it. And I was kind of scared. Again, I'm back in fear and pain. And I thought, well, now how am I going to do that? But I decided I'd better. So in that step, what I found in the word keystone and looking it up, because it talks about if we do this and when we do it, when we're able to, that we will walk through the archway of freedom. Freedom from the bondage of self. Now, in looking that word up, if you can envision an archway, that third step is the stone that is placed in that archway of which everything else is built around. And if it is not firmly in place, just the slightest little movement and it'll crumple. And your whole program will begin to crumple around you. Because without that power, without our source, because God now, when we have turned our life and our will over to the care of God, God now is the source. He's going to be the director. He is not going to go to work for you. Understand that. So many of us think, well, now that we've turned our life and our will over to the care of God, that God is now going to go to work for us. Because we've turned everything over to Him and He's going to take care of it all. And how many times have you had somebody say, oh, just turn it over. Just turn it over. Well, I got news for you. You turn it over and He's going to turn it back. And you're going to get something that you ain't wanting. Seems like every time I ask for something for myself, He gives me just the opposite. You know, I asked for patience and He gave me Hugh. So I've learned to have patience. So, you know, when they tell you to be careful what you ask for, you know, that's what they mean. Because you don't know what you're going to get. Because God ain't going to do it for you. He'll do for you what you cannot do for yourself, not what you will not do. And that's very important. That's not a play on words. So here I am in the third step, and the principle that I got out of that was willingness. The willingness to do what was necessary. The willingness now, instead of having a husband as a boss or a teacher as a boss or my mom and daddy as a boss now, I had to learn and become willing to be responsible for Beverly. And that is very difficult for most of us to do. I've always had a boss so that I had somebody else to blame when anything went wrong in my life. And so many of us do that with our sponsors. I can only remember firing one baby. And I had told her, she was brand new, I said, you don't drink no matter what. And she wanted to get a divorce immediately because she had a hot thing going with one of her spiritual advisors, who, of course, was man. She had met him right off. And there was a little hanky-panky going on, and I told her, no, she couldn't get a divorce. That it was necessary that, you know, just in the short period of time she had, she didn't know what she got with her husband. And she might be throwing something good away and not even knowing it. And I said, then you'll be sorry. She would have been, too, because I knew this other guy she was playing around with. And she'd have been real sorry if she'd thrown that husband away. He couldn't have been any worse, I know. But anyway, she came back to me. She got drunk. She came back to me, and she said, she's standing out in my front yard, and she said, well, it was because of you I got drunk. And I said, well, why do you figure that one? She said, well, you told me I couldn't get a divorce. I said, I also told you not to drink. I And I said, I just refuse to take the responsibility. Well, you're not a very good sponsor. And I said, well, then go find you another one, somebody that you can follow directions from. But I'm not going to be responsible for your drinking. And I'm not going to be responsible for your life. I'm going to be responsible for helping you to learn what's in this big book called Alcoholics Anonymous. And you're going to have to find your way. And that's what my sponsor had told me. And you see, I can only give away what I have found here. Now, in this book, it says that there is a process in our solution in which we have to go by. And in order to consummate this progress, it says there has to be a self-searching, a leveling of our pride, and a confession of our shortcomings. In a general way, that's what I'm going to be doing here with you as I go along each week and going through the steps and the principles that I have found that I've had to apply to my life. And there's more than one principle in these steps, in each one of these steps. But you see, I haven't come from where you have, and each one of us have our own way of life and our own pattern, our own morals or values, if you will. Even though I think in the end that we're all pretty close together, when you get it right down to it, in the end we'll find out we're all pretty close. But for each one of us, we have to do it in God's time. And I don't know what God's time is for you, and I don't know what God's way is for you. I only know what it has been so far for me. So now I've got three principles in the first three steps, and I've got honesty, open-mindedness, and willingness. And remember when I said, when the book says that we have written a book which we believe to be moral as well as spiritual, and that I didn't believe that my drunkenness was a moral issue, but I had come to believe that my sobriety was. So I had to begin to find out what my morals were. So it was through the first three principles that I was finally able and willing to go into the fourth step, which was to take an inventory of myself, to take a fearless and searching moral inventory. Now, in that step, I learned the principle of truth. Because if you're going to take an inventory, it has no value to it unless it's going to be an honest moral inventory. And honest deals with integrity. Truth deals with fact. There's a difference. You see, I can be truthful with you and not be honest. But in the fourth step, the principle that I found there was one of truth. And what I began to do was to find some fact-facing, fact-finding facts about Beverly. So I went back in there. And it also talks in there, and some of the things that I found. Now, by this time, I'm about a little over 3 years sober. Now, for me, I found out that when I first came into AA, I run through the steps. And what I was doing was not taking them in their entirety, but certainly taking them. Okay? What I was doing was really becoming acquainted with them. I was kind of testing them out and becoming acquainted. So I found that for me, what I had been doing was really is taking about one step a year. You can pretty much tell where a person is at and what step that they're really applying into their life at the time if you'll listen to the problems they're having at the time or what they're talking about the most. And you'll usually hear a step in there that they're, you know, using at this time in their life. And so here I was. And I'm ready now to take this moral inventory and begin to face myself with the exact natures of my wrongs, not the results of my wrongs. Hell, I knew those, you know. But the question, again, is what I didn't know. What was I doing that was causing these results? And you've heard that cliche here in AA. If you're hurting, stop doing what you're doing that's causing you to hurt. Totally totally unacceptable, right? I want to do what I want to do when I want to do it and get by with it. And I want the results this time now to be different. We want to find a way to get by with it instead of get away from it. And it didn't work for me. I don't believe it's going to work for you either. You see, I don't believe that my case is different anymore. So how am I going to get away from it? Because I've got to know what's causing it. And it's called cause and effect. If I do this over here, I'm going to get the effect over here. And I didn't like the results of the effect that I was getting, again, from the way I was leading my life. So I had to find out what it was I was doing, and what it was I was doing is called the exact natures of my wrongs. Now it says, setting aside the wrongs others have done us, wherein are we wrong? Well, I didn't want to hear that. I wanted to tell you all about how and what he did. You know, he was the one that was wrong. And they're saying, no, you know, we don't want to know that. Wherein were you wrong? So I had to begin to learn what truth was, and I had to sit down and face myself and begin to find out. It talks about in there also that you're going to make a resentment list. On top of finding out the exact natures of your wrongs, you're going to make a resentment list of the people you resent at. And this is very important, because when I came in here, and I don't think that I'm a lot different from most of you, I didn't know that I had a burning rage going on inside of me. Didn't know it. When you said resentments, I don't have any resentments. You know, God, I'm submissive and subservient. How can you be submissive and subservient and have resentments? And all the time, this burning rage is going on. Well, after all of a sudden, you know, this one woman, I remember when I took my first year cake, she came up to me and she laid her hand on my shoulder and she said, "Oh, Beverly, you've changed so much this year." She said, "I used to be so afraid of you. You were so angry and hostile." And I remember turning around to her and said, "What the hell do you mean I was hostile and angry?" I had no idea what she was talking about. I didn't know that I was. And it says we must get rid of these resentments, because from resentment stem all form of spiritual diseases. So the fourth step is a very, very important step too. And you see, if I hadn't have been able to turn my life and my will over to the care of God in that third step, I don't think that I would have been able to have faced the truth about me as well as I was able to. So I believe that for tonight I'm going to stop right there, because I've been told to throw this open now to some questions and answers. So again now, in the first four steps, I have honesty, open-mindedness, willingness, and truth. Out of the first four steps, those four principles are what I had begun to live by. And my life was certainly on a spiritual level, because I had had an elevation of thought and feeling. Okay? Thank you for that. And now it's your turn. Yes. Hi, Helen. Can I give you an example of the difference between truth and honesty? Okay, I'm going to steal a story from my husband, because it is so good. Okay? And he talks about this, because this was one of the lessons that he had to learn, and it explains it so beautifully. There was two people, and they were both married to somebody else, and they decided to get together and go to this motel. So they did. And when they got to the motel keeper there asked them, they said, "Are you married?" And they said, "Yes, we are." So with that, he gave them the key, and they went on into the room. Now, what was wrong with that? Can you tell me? Mm-hmm. You see, because they told the truth, they were married. They just weren't married to each other. However, had they been honest, they would not have been there. Because again, truth, honesty deals with integrity. Truth deals with a fact. And I can't think of a better way to explain it than that story that he tells. Okay? Yes.
Hi,
Mary. Truth is truth. I don't care whether it's something we're dealing with today or tomorrow. Truth is always a fact, regardless of where it's at. Even though my values may be changing and my principles or my morals or anything else, truth is a constant. It's always there. So how can truth be different tomorrow than it is today if it's truth?
Well, for instance,
The question that you presented was... Well, for tomorrow... If today it's blue and tomorrow it's gray, that's the truth. You know, I can be an angry person today, and tomorrow I can be just as happy as a lark. And today for me to be angry is a truth. Tomorrow for me to be happy as a lark would also be a truth. So it's the facts as they are as of the moment. Okay? Does that explain it? Yes. Well, I'll tell you, as my mind began to open up, remember, I'm keeping an open mind now, and I'm looking the question, what was that again, honey? I wanted to repeat it. How I really pinpointed my resentments if I thought I didn't have any. Okay. In there it says to make a resentment list in the book, and it shows us exactly how to do it. Okay. Now, a resentment it was something that I felt, okay, that was either real or imagined, that somebody had done or said against me or an action they had taken against me. Now, I think that I don't really think that that's too difficult. The thing of it was is that I would never think about these things. I would always push them down inside of me and not think. But, you know, if you're feeling uncomfortable or you're feeling badly, just ask yourself the question. See? Ask the question. That's one of the most important things that I can tell you. Is learn to ask yourself the question. Why am I feeling this way? Who am I feeling it at? And is it coming to me or is it coming from me? Is it something that I think that somebody said or did, or is it something that I have done? Because in any of these, we're going to have to learn the questions. And these were part of the questions. And am I resenting myself or am I resenting you? And what I found for me is that many's the time, in fact, most of the time, I found that I was resenting myself for putting myself in the position to have somebody either do or say. And most of the time, it was just to pull myself back and back away. And at other times, it would be to confront. Because a lot of times I found out that if I was willing, remember I had said that I was willing to go to any lengths for victory over alcohol. And I'm not a very brave person, and I'm always afraid that people won't like me. And for me to confront somebody and say to them, what did you mean when you said this? Oh, God, I would just be terrified because I'd be, number one, afraid they wouldn't like me or that they were going to attack me. So I had to learn to confront. First, I had to ask myself, is this coming to me or from me? And where is it coming from? And why am I feeling this way? There were questions. And that was how I learned then from my resentment. And a lot of them are so blatant, like I resented my mother because she did so and so, you know, and just setting them down, just exactly like the book shows us. That helps. Oh, I forgot you had your hand raised. You didn't? Okay. Any other questions? God, I'm good. You mean I explained myself that well, huh?
Well, I think I got one.
Hi, Dick. How I put how does pride correlate with resentments being the number one offender? Number one, we're talking about false pride. And false pride is ego. And one of the first lessons that we learn is that our egos have to be smashed. We learn to become humble, and that was one of the principles, if you will, that I will be talking about, that I learned. Now, it doesn't mean that pride in oneself, because pride can be a good thing, too. Any of the seven deadly sins, you know, any of the things, God gave us all things. It's how we use them that makes them, quote, either good or bad. And if this pride has turned into a false pride where my ego is out of proportion, then it's become one of the seven deadly sins. And if the book says that that is what comes up first, and that's what we put at the top of our list, then I would say follow the directions in the book and put that at the top of my list. And we, as I said, we don't get rid of pride in oneself, but certainly we have to learn how to become humble. And when you can become humble, that gets rid of the false pride. So it kind of takes care of itself as we learn and bring into our lives the principles. And later on, next week, I will be talking about how and what I had to go through in order to humble myself, to bring my pride down to, and my ego down to where it should be. Okay, and you had a question. Okay, that was in there. First we have to make a decision. Then we have to want what they have here. Okay? And then willing to go to any length to get it. Those were the three conditions. That was your question. What were the three conditions before we could begin to take the steps? Okay? Hand back there. Hi, Carol. Do resentments create fears? For me, they do. Yes. In fact, it's from fear that I get resentment. Does that make sense to anybody? When I am fearing not getting something I want, or that I'm going to lose something I've got, and God forbid, you know, I start getting resentful and trying to hold on to it, or in order to the things that I have to do, I think, you know, to go to get it. And, yes. I believe that it would be, yes, that is the same as leveling our egos or our false pride. Okay? Yes. Hi, Gary. Your sponsor told you that either drunk or sober that your life was unmanageable. And you want to know how that, if it's really true, what your sponsor said, is that what you're asking me?
Yeah, basically.
Okay.
I have an opinion already.
Well, just keep an open mind. Don't, you know, hold on to your opinion. You are entitled to that. And then what you will do is pretty soon you will know. It won't just be an opinion. Okay. For me, I have found that even sober, that my life is unmanageable without the help of God as I understand Him. As I said tonight when I got up here, I'm having a lot of trouble physically. I have arthritis and I'm in a lot of pain. And when you're in pain, it's very hard to hold two thoughts together. And I ask God for help, you know, and I hope that He has granted to me the help that I've needed tonight to reach you and get the message across to you of what the principles have come to mean to me and what I have found for me, so that hopefully that you too will be able to open up your mind and to understand what the book is saying, not just what I have said, but by what I have said. It will help you to open up your mind to find what you need to find for you in order for you to stay sober. And it is time for me to close, and I thank you very much for the privilege of being here and sharing with you tonight. Thank you.